the book The Hiding Place by Corrie Ten Boom. Anyone ever read The Hiding Place? All right, those who haven't read it, you need to seriously evaluate how you're living your life. But it's an incredible book, and in that book, it tells the story of Corrie and her sister Betsy Ten Boom. They were a Dutch Christian family when the Nazis invaded in 1940, and they courageously opened their home to rescue Jews who were being hunted down by the Nazis. And because of their courage, they were ratted out by some of their neighbors, and the Nazis arrested them, and they were sent to the only exclusive concentration camp for women in Nazi Germany. It was Ravensbrück. Ravensbrück is located in Prussia, the northeastern part of Germany, right next to a town called Fürstenberg. So Kathleen and I, we traveled to Fürstenberg because we wanted to go to Ravensbrück. We wanted to see the place where Corrie Ten Boom suffered for the Lord, where her sister Betsy actually passed away, was swept into eternity. And it was really just sort of a pilgrimage for us. We wanted to be there. We wanted to walk the grounds where Corrie and Betsy walked. And I have to tell you, before I became a pastor, I was a high school teacher in New Jersey public high schools for over a decade. And I was a history teacher, and one of my areas of expertise was the Holocaust. So I taught an entire course on the Holocaust, went to the Holocaust Museum in Washington a number of times, had the privilege of interviewing Holocaust survivors, really a passion of mine. So I was, you could say, thoroughly prepared to tour Ravensbrück. So when we got there and we saw the barbed wire on the wall surrounding the exterior of the concentration camp, didn't faze me at all. When we walked through the museum and saw the bunks where women were forced to sleep, 4 women per bunk crammed in to these horrible flea-ridden barracks. What a horrible situation. But I wasn't fazed by it. I was prepared. I wasn't even fazed when we saw the crematorium. I mean, laid eyes on it, saw the exact ovens where they burned the remains of over 100,000 women who died at Ravensbrück. And you know what? I wasn't even fazed when I stood and looked at this cobblestone mass grave underneath which lies the remains of over 100,000 women who were swept into eternity at Ravensbrück. I was even prepared to see the SS Commandant's home, this luxurious home that was located about 150 yards from the gas chambers. And this is where this SS officer lived with his wife and his children in a luxurious home while women were being gassed and burned just 150 yards away. I was even prepared for that. But then I saw something that was so disturbing, something I was completely unprepared for. I had to take a video of it. It's not graphic, don't worry, but I have to show you this video. So this is me on my phone, standing looking at the outer wall of Ravensbrück, and then I'm doing a pan because there's a beautiful lake. And about 200 yards, about 2 football fields across the lake, you see the village of Fürstenberg. And if you looked carefully, you would have noticed that there is a church steeple looming high above the rest of the village of Fürstenberg. And all of a sudden, it hit me. There was a church that was located less than 2 football fields away from the Ravensbrück concentration camp. And all of a sudden, I started to ask myself, did they know? Did these Christians know what was happening? They would have seen the forced labor groups. They would have seen the women working outside the camp being worked to death. And as I was reading about what it was like to be in Ravensbrück, Corrie records in her book, she talks about how day and night, human ash spewing out of the chimneys of the crematorium would just spread ash all over Ravensbrück. And she said on a really windy day, the ash would blow across the lake. And then I wondered, could the people in this church, could they smell the human ash as it was drifting across the lake? Did they know? I think they did. The more important question is, did they care? Did they care? As a student of history, I know that throughout the past 2 millennium, the Lord Jesus has used his people, has used the blood-bought church of Christ to push back against the evil of the world. If we go back to the 3rd century in the Roman Empire, When people didn't want a baby, particularly baby girls, you know what they would do? They would throw them on a literal trash pile outside the town, and the babies would die of exposure. But do you know who went and picked up the babies? It was the Christians, and adopted them into their families. We fast forward to the horrors of the slave trade. Do you know who brought about an end of the slave trade in the British Empire? A man named William Wilberforce, an unapologetic evangelical Christian, driven by his faith to expose darkness and then do something about it. Here in our own country, it was evangelical Christians who exposed the evil of slavery. They're the ones who brought the Civil War upon this country. We fast forward to the 20th century. There were Christians marching in the streets of the cities of this nation, Christians who were suffering and even dying in the South because they dared to believe that every single human being, regardless of the color of their skin, deserved equal protection under the law. You see, God uses his people to fight against injustice. And I'm here to tell you tonight that abortion is the darkest darkness in our country today. I believe it is the single most significant, the gravest darkness, the gravest injustice in our culture today. You know, many Christians are, you might say, asleep at the wheel when it comes to abortion, because they heard somewhere that the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, so that means there's no more abortion. Think again, my friends. All the Supreme Court did was kick abortion back to the states. Yeah, it's exciting to see states like Florida and Texas and Mississippi and Tennessee eliminating abortion. That's exciting. That's encouraging. But guess what has changed here in New Jersey? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing has changed. In fact, our leaders are actually doubling down on abortion. They want New Jersey to be the abortion capital of the United States. The reality is, even after the elimination of Roe versus Wade in 2024, last year, there were 1.1 million abortions in the United States. Over a million babies swept into eternity in 2024 alone. That's about 3,000 babies per day. That's more than the people who died on 9/11 every single day are being swept into eternity through abortion. Nothing has changed in New Jersey. And I came across some statistics a couple years ago that absolutely blew my mind. You see, I discovered that there's only one state in the United States that has more abortion clinics than they do pregnancy resource centers. And I'll tell you, it's not California, it's not New York, it's not Massachusetts or Connecticut, it is New Jersey. We are the only state in the United States that has more abortion facilities than pregnancy resource centers. Last year in New Jersey, one out of every three pregnancies ended in abortion. I believe New Jersey is the darkest darkness in the United States when it comes to abortion. And statistically, it is the single most dangerous place for a baby in the womb. It's here in the state of New Jersey. I believe in my bones this is the gravest injustice of our day. It's the darkest darkness in our culture. And I believe that God has called his people. God has called the blood-bought church of Jesus Christ to be a voice for the voiceless. To have a spiritual backbone that says, I see evil and I'm going to expose it. I believe that's what God is calling his people to do. So tonight is just an opportunity to just kind of scratch the surface. What does pro-life apologetics mean? What does it mean as a Christian to think critically about this serious issue and be able to communicate to those who disagree with us a compelling case for life? That's what tonight is about. We want to learn to offer cogent, convincing arguments in the defense of life. So there are a lot of ways that we can talk through this. But I want us to zero in on what we might call trust the science. When it comes to pro-life apologetics, when you're having conversations with people, the overwhelming majority of the time, someone who is pro-choice is not going to be a follower of Jesus Christ. They are not going to have a biblical worldview. So if you go and you're quoting Genesis 1, 26 and 27, every single human being bears the imago Dei, the image of God. They're like, what the heck are you talking about? That means nothing to me. So we have to learn not to present a biblical case for life to people who do not value the Bible as being the inspired word of God. We need to learn to present a case for life that is rooted in science. That is rooted in science. And if you begin to investigate some of the great pro-life apologists of our day, you will see that this is the foundation of their argument, because they're arguing with people who have a totally different worldview. They're arguing with people who generally bow down at the idol of science. So if you use science to communicate a cogent case that babies in the womb are human beings and deserve equal justice under the law, using this scientific argument is very compelling. Now, there are philosophical arguments. There are certainly moral arguments. But it's really strategic for us to learn to communicate using science, communicating to people who believe, who have a worldview that's centered on science, to present a compelling case. I want you to hear me. There are plenty of places you can go in the Bible, of course, to defend life. You can use ethics, you can use philosophy, you can use morality. But what I find to be most compelling in having a conversation with someone is to begin with science. Trust the science when it comes to a pro-life argument. So I'm going to share just a few quotes from people who are not Christians, not even in the zip code of being Christians, but are experts in their field. And all these quotes, by the way, are from a book called Why Pro-Life. Some of you might be familiar with Randy Alcorn, Eternal Perspectives Ministries. He is an excellent pro-life apologist. He wrote a very short but compelling book called Why Pro-Life, and I pulled all these quotes out of the book. So the first quote is from a University of Pennsylvania doctor, Dr. Alfred Bongiani, and he says this, quote, "I have learned from my earliest medical education that human life begins at the time of conception. Human life is present throughout this entire sequence from conception to adulthood, and any interruption at any point throughout this time constitutes a termination of human life." He continues, "I am no more prepared to say that these early stages represent an incomplete human being than I would be to say that the child prior to the dramatic effects of puberty is not a human being. This is human life at every stage." This is an unregenerate doctor who works at University of Pennsylvania Hospital, and he is clearly saying that life begins at conception. Dr. Micheline Matthews-Roth, she is at Harvard Medical School. She says this, quote, "It is scientifically correct to say that an individual human life begins at conception." Dr. Jerome Lejeune, a genetics professor at the University of Descartes over in France, he writes this, "After fertilization has taken place, a new human being has come into being. This is no longer a matter of taste or opinion. Each individual has a very neat beginning at conception." Science is clear when it comes to when human life begins. Science clearly states that at the moment of conception, a new, unique human life comes into existence. Therefore, the question isn't when does human life begin? Is it at 6 weeks with a heartbeat? Is it at 20 weeks where a baby is viable outside of the womb with special medical intervention? Or is it after the baby has been born? That's nonsense, scientifically speaking. Scientifically speaking, human life begins at conception. Now, what's really interesting is the more science delves into the life of a baby inside the womb, the more science exposes a biblical worldview. Isn't that fascinating? I love when scientists catch up to the Bible. It's like one of my favorite things. When scientists catch up to the Bible, it's so encouraging. It really is. And something happened in 1999 that really began to change the landscape. It changed the medical conversation and then started to change cultural conversations surrounding this issue of when does life begin, whether a baby inside the womb truly is human. That was kind of the question going back to the 80s and the 90s. So this next image, I'm just going to give you a heads up. It's pretty graphic. So I'm going to show you an image here in just a minute. This is a spina bifida surgery that a surgeon did on a baby who was around 20 weeks gestation in the womb, and the scientist actually opened up the womb so that he could perform surgery on the spine of this baby. Okay, so if this is not your cup of tea, this is my warning to you that this next image is a little bloody. It's nothing crazy, but I'm just giving you a heads up. All right, this image was called the Hand of Hope. It's really fascinating. So this is a baby around 20, 21 weeks, and the doctor performed surgery, and when he opened up the woman's stomach, opened up her womb, all of a sudden the baby's arm pushed out. The doctor was not anticipating this. The baby's arm pushed out and then kind of pulled back in a little bit, but the hand was still outside the womb. And the doctor put his finger to this 20, 21-year-old baby's hand, and what he realized was the baby squeezed on his finger. And he even moved his finger a little bit to see, and the baby held on to his finger. And because this was like revolutionary surgery, this was like cutting-edge surgery, they had a photojournalist, a guy named Michael Clancy. He was in there taking pictures of the surgery. He took this picture, and he writes this, quote, "Suddenly, an entire arm thrust out of the opening, then pulled back, just a little hand was showing. The doctor reached over and lifted the hand, which reacted and squeezed the doctor's finger, as if testing for strength. The doctor shook the tiny fist. Samuel, that's the baby's name, held firm. After performing that spinal surgery on the baby, the doctor sewed the womb back up, and then 4 months later, this little baby boy was born. The photojournalist, he said, in an instant, he changed from being pro-choice to pro-life. Because in that instant, he realized it is not a clump of cells inside the woman's womb. It's not just a fetus inside the womb. It's a baby. It's a baby. It's a real, live, distinct human being. He said at that moment, he changed his perspective. He went from being pro-choice to being pro-life. He said this, "I was totally in shock for 2 hours after the surgery. I know abortion is wrong now. It's absolutely wrong." What's so cool is Samuel Armis is now 26 years old. He's 26 years old. And because of that life-saving surgery, he is around today. The foundation of the pro-life position is that humanity begins at conception. So if we can communicate that a baby in the womb is a distinct human being, that changes everything. And what's so cool is science has actually transformed the whole conversation. Because when we couldn't see inside the womb before ultrasound, or when we didn't have images like this of this spina bifida surgery, everyone was just debating, oh, what's inside? When does life begin? It's actually not a relevant conversation anymore. So if someone wants to debate that, they're like 30 to 40 years behind the science. They're totally behind. But if we can establish, as communicators of a pro-life position, if we can establish that a baby inside the womb is human with its own fingerprints, a distinct heartbeat, brainwaves, there's human life inside the womb, then all of a sudden we can now say, because the baby in the womb is a distinct human being, then that baby deserves human rights. That baby deserves equal protection under the law. That's the foundation of a pro-life argument. Now, it's important to kind of know some specific facts, some specific details about this. So, for example, right around 5-6 weeks, a baby has a heartbeat, a discernible heartbeat. Around 5 to 6 weeks, a baby has detectable brain waves. These are important things to understand. And by the time a baby is around like the 16 to 18 week time, that baby now, all they're doing for the rest of the pregnancy is just growing in size. All the organs are in place. All the critical systems inside the baby's body are in place. The baby is just getting bigger in anticipation of birth. This is critical. This is really important for us to understand. Now, there is a pro-life apologist out there, a guy named Scott Klusendorf. I believe, Joanne, you have some of his books here available for people, which is awesome. Scott Klusendorf heads up the Life Training Institute. This is a guy who was a pastor, felt this call to be full-time pro-life ministry, and he's done an excellent job communicating a case for life specifically rooted in science and helping Christians to understand that when it comes to defending life, really what you're doing is you are communicating that our humanity is not contingent on our size. It's not contingent on our level of human development. It's not contingent on the environment in which we find someone. And it's not contingent on a human being's degree of dependency on someone else to live. Scott Klusendorf calls this the SLED acronym. This is really, really important. And by the way, if you have followed Charlie Kirk and ever heard him debate about abortion on college campuses, we're going to look at a clip a little bit later. But as I was watching some of Charlie Kirk's videos as he's defending life, what I realized is, that boy's been reading Scott Klusendorf. All of his arguments were based on the SLED acronym, and he executed them with absolute genius. Absolute genius. But every debate I watched, I was like, oh, he's using level of development. Oh, he's using degree of dependency. Oh, he's using size. He's using environment. He did it so, so well. So well. To a point when the college student was like walking up to the microphone, I was like, yo, this joker's about to get absolutely eviscerated on the pro-life question. But this is something that's really, really important for us to understand. Every pro-choice argument, think with me for a minute. Every pro-choice argument can pretty much be diffused by the SLED acronym. That's wild if you stop and think about it. If you can begin to understand what Scott Klusendorf is communicating here when it comes to size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency, it's the foundation for every pro-life argument when you're having a conversation with someone who does not know the Lord, who would not have the same biblical worldview. So what I want us to do is I want us to actually listen to Scott Klusendorf. There's a short video, and he's going to communicate to us this idea behind the SLED acronym. Let's go ahead and take a look.
Hi, I'm Scott Klusendorf. I'm president of Life Training Institute. If you were asked to develop a pro-life argument that could be communicated in 2 minutes or less, could you do it? Could you make a case that a secular person would accept, a person who doesn't want religious arguments for the pro-life view? I'm going to show you how to do that. The first thing you want to do is point out that this debate is not about choice, it's not about privacy, it's about one question: what is the unborn? I mean, think about it. Would anybody you know argue we can kill two-year-olds in the name of trusting women? No, they only argue that way because they think the unborn aren't human. So let's start with that first question: what is the unborn? You use science to demonstrate that the unborn are distinct, living and whole human beings. Every embryology textbook in the world indicates that's true. You didn't come from an embryo, you once were an embryo. But you've also got to do philosophy, because science can't tell us how to treat the unborn. We need philosophy to tell us how to do that. Philosophically, there's only 4 differences between that embryo you once were and the adult you are today, and not one of them justifies killing you at that earlier stage of development. As Stephen Schwartz points out, there's a difference of size, a difference of level of development, a difference of environment, meaning where you're located, and a difference of degree of dependency. Think of the acronym SLED, and you'll remember these 4 differences. Size: you were smaller as an embryo, but large people don't have a greater right to life than small people. Your level of development was less as an embryo, but since when does that matter? 2-year-old girls are less developed than 14-year-old girls. We don't think the 2-year-old has less of a right to life. What about your environment, where you're located? You were in the womb, now you're out. But how does where you are determine what you are? When you rolled over in bed last night, you changed location, but you didn't stop being you. And finally, degree of dependency. While it's true you depended on your mother for survival when you were young, since when does that mean we can kill you? Conjoined twins depend on each other's bodily systems. We don't think they forfeit their right to life. Size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency. Think SLED. Those are the only 4 differences between that embryo you once were and the adult you are today, and not one of those is a good reason for saying you could be killed then, but not now. That's how you do it. Use science to show the unborn are human. Use philosophy to show there's no relevant difference between what we were in the womb and what we are today that would justify killing us.
You see how that works? It's cogent. It's simple, it's easy to recall, It's of critical importance. So what I want to do right now is let's take a look at a few common pro-choice talking points, and let's see if we can identify which of the SLED acronym, the size, the level of development, the environment, or degree of dependency that would kind of like diffuse or combat that talking point. Okay, so you might hear someone who's pro-choice say, a fetus is a part of the woman's body, so it's her choice. It's her body, it's her choice. So which of those SLED, which in the acronym there would be relevant here, most relevant in responding? Environment, right? They're speaking to the environment of that baby, right? So you could say something like this, well, you know what, if that's part of the woman's body, then that woman actually has two noses, she has four eyes, and she has 20 fingers. And what you're doing is you're not only revealing the distinctness of that baby inside the womb, right, but we're helping them understand that someone's environment does not dictate whether or not they are a person. Now, you might hear someone say, a pro-choice argument, the fetus is totally dependent on the mother. It can't survive without it. Therefore, the fetus doesn't have any rights. Well, which part of the SLED acronym speaks to that? Degree of dependency, right? So you could say, well, if I'm following your logic, then anyone who's dependent on kidney dialysis machines or anyone who's on a ventilator has no human rights according to your logic. Do you see how that works? You didn't say one thing about Psalm 139, which is wonderful and glorious and true. You didn't quote any scripture, but you prevented a very cogent case. You're challenging someone on their terms and really drawing out how flawed their thinking really is. Another pro-choice talking point, the baby can't think or make decisions on its own. It's not autonomous, therefore it has no right. Which one would that be? Level of development, right? So your response could be, at what point does a human have rights? Once they can make all decisions on their own? Once they can live on their own without their parents? What's the standard? At what point is someone developed enough that we would say they deserve human rights? And when you have those kind of talking points, when you're able to expose just really how thin, how weak the pro-choice position is, it's actually very humbling for someone. They might raise their voice, they might get upset, but guess what? It's because they have nothing logical to say in response. So these are very, very compelling. I think they're very helpful. And what I want to do right now is I want to take a look at a video of Charlie Kirk on a college campus. I'm not an expert on Charlie Kirk, but as I've read, as I've watched some of the videos, a very large percentage of his conversations that he was having with college students were actually on abortion. He wasn't the one bringing it up. The college students were bringing up over and over and over again. So as you're watching this, I want you to think about which part of the SLED acronym. Is it size? Is it level of development? Is it environment or degree of dependency? Which of the talking points is Charlie Kirk using to help expose just how illogical and weak the pro-choice position is? Let's go ahead and take a look at this clip of Charlie Kirk.
Hi, Charlie. I see you on TikTok all the time.
You were getting fired up there. Yeah.
Yes, I was because, okay, I just want to start this out. I am unaffiliated, but I am a Christian who believes in the right to an abortion. And a lot of the things that you were talking about with her, I really had a lot of answers for that. So the reason I actually wrote this down on a notebook, of course, I was prepared. So the reason why I believe the right to an abortion, why just anyone, if you feel that's what you need to do, then you should do it. Because Matthew 7:1 says, do not judge or you too will be judged. Although Jesus does tell us to tell people do not sin, it's not our place to judge them, you know? And then another thing that I wanted to bring up, this is crazy, but also the time, I just really want to know why you feel that abortion should be illegal.
Do you think murder should be illegal?
Murder is illegal.
So you think it should be? Do you think it should be illegal?
I just feel like there's a big difference between a living, breathing human and then a fetus that is inside of another human's body.
Fair enough. What is the difference?
The difference is a fetus is inside of the body. You know what I'm saying? Like a fetus, it can't live on its own.
Got it. So let's go through a couple questions there. Okay. Why does somebody's location determine their moral worth?
It doesn't, but it's simply about the fact that if you feel like that's what you need to do with your body, then that's what you do. Because I could also...
Hold on a second. If it's not your DNA, how is it your body?
It is your DNA.
No, it's not.
It's a part of you. It's growing in you. It's connected to you by an umbilical cord. It is a part of you.
One second. It's attached.
A part.
It's attached. Hold on a second. It's attached, not a part.
Same
because,
thing.
No, it's actually not. A part, by definition, means it remains permanent.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Oh, okay.
So an attachment is something that is temporary. And so it's not, you are not your mom's DNA. You're not your dad's DNA. You are new deoxyribonucleic acid. So shouldn't we say that if it's not your DNA, it's not your choice?
I mean, you could say that, but I mean, really, this is... I just don't understand how you can use religion to back up your point of...
I haven't used it once. She brought up religion. I'm happy to use a non-religious line of questioning. We all agree murder is wrong.
Okay.
We all agree that it's a human homo sapien.
Do you agree that the death penalty is wrong?
Well, no, I'm actually in support of the death penalty because people do something that justifies that. But that's a separate issue because the baby in utero... did not
so what about the people who could possibly be proved innocent who have been awaiting their death sentence?
Fair enough. That's a good argument, but it's separate, right? So there's been about 31 exonerations of posthumous people that have been exonerated the death penalty. We're talking about a baby that did nothing wrong except exist.
Okay.
In utero. And there's about 1.5 million of them that just get discarded every year. So we agree murder is wrong. We agree it's a homo sapien, meaning it's a human being. Therefore, murder is the forcible termination of a homo sapien. Therefore, shouldn't abortion be wrong and illegal?
I still feel like it really, like, okay, for example.
But to prove to me why. You use an ABC logical equation, right? So tell me under what standard, therefore, very simple, right? You're in college. You guys do this all the time, right?
Yep.
I hope so. So use an ABC, right? Aristotelian logic, whatever you want to use. Use an ABC sequence for me. Not
my
I feel.
Reasoning why I believe that abortion should be legal is because of instances like rape and incest, but I already know that your belief on that because you've already stated that if your daughter were to be raped at 10 years old, you would make her give
birth
to the baby.
Well, the baby would be delivered, and let me tell you why. And so, but first of all, let me try to find common ground.
Okay.
If I say we will make rape and incest abortions legal and get rid of all the other abortions, would you agree with that?
Can you repeat that? I'm so sorry.
If I say that we will allow abortions to continue for rape and incest, life of the mother, but all other abortions should be illegal, which is 99.4% of the time, can we make those 99% of abortions illegal?
Yeah, see, I don't believe that abortion should be used as a form of birth control.
So 99% of the time it is. That's all that we're debating in the country right now. So Charlie Kirk's position is a very fringe minority. People are talking about still exceptions, so we should get rid of 99% of abortions.
Yes, but at the same time...
So you're actually not that pro-choice, actually.
But I am, because I feel like there's no way to kind of divide the basis of, like, what abortion is being used as birth control and what abortion is being...
Oh, it's totally easy, actually. I mean, so you could tell through a DNA test if it's an incest baby.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell if it's rape because they have to file a police report. And you could tell life of the mother based on... an OBGYN analysis. So
if it's that easy, then why have we not done that?
Oh, because the American people don't support it. Because abortion is popularly supported as a form of birth control. That's why. So your position is actually a very rational one, and I respect you for it. 99% of all abortions are done just because people want the baby gone. 99%. That's not Charlie Kirk's numbers. That's the Guttmacher Institute, which was funded by Planned Parenthood.
Okay. So feel as though, like, people who are victims of rape and incest, do you think that they should be able to get an abortion?
So just so we can agree on the 99%, then I'm going to try to win you over on the other percent.
Okay.
Got it. So we're good on the 99? Get rid of those abortions?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Somebody in this audience was conceived in rape. Can you tell me who?
No.
Nah.
Why? I thought that they're less human.
Those words never came out of my mouth.
No, I know, but the insinuation of allowing rape for abortion is that they're not as human, therefore they should be murdered.
No, that's not the it's more about the mental toll that it would take on the mother to have that
baby. Oh, I totally acknowledge the mental toll, but shouldn't the human being conceived in rape still get human rights?
Yes, but it should be more up to the mother who has to carry the baby and who has to push it.
Well, hold on, let's play that out. So even though the mom has to push it, do you still have a right to terminate somebody? Can you take away human rights if your life's going to get difficult to somebody else? If somebody else is making your life difficult, can you take away their human rights?
No, but at the same time, that's like that should that's where like the question comes in that it should be up between the person, like the.
But why? By what standard is that okay? For example, if a single mom has two kids, and all of a sudden she loses her job, and one of the kids is super annoying and has a learning disability, should she be able to murder that kid because it's an inconvenience to her?
No.
No, of course not.
Not after like.
But why is it that all of a sudden you get the you get considered a human being after birth, but before birth you're not?
Because after birth, you can, you know, you're kind of living on your own. You're not in the mother's body.
No, you're not. Hold on. I have a six-month-old. My baby is not living on its own.
Not living on its own, but it can breathe on its own.
Hold on a second. Over 500,000 babies every year are born in NICU, which require, which is a prenatal assistance, breathing assistance, digestive assistance. And so are they not human because they can't viability, they have any viability? The point is that the standard doesn't apply, right? Let me ask you one more hypothetical, and it's a good question. I'll do a Christian one because you say you're a Christian on that. I have two ultrasounds.
Mm-hmm.
One ultrasound is a baby that was conceived in rape. The other ultrasound is a baby conceived in a loving relationship. Which one is which?
There's no difference. There's no difference in the physical appearance of it, but the like the complete difference is the mental toll that it would take on the mother
sure,
and the person who has to carry the baby for nine months.
Well, hold on. Let's be clear. There's a mental toll when you have an abortion, too. So it's not as if it's a get-out-of-free jail card.
No, I completely understand
so
that.
So it's a tough, difficult, horrible situation,
yeah.
But shouldn't we be that the worst outcome after an evil is to just murder the being?
Why punish the baby?
Yeah, no. Why punish the baby for the crime of some guy that raped the mother? Why all of a sudden have two victims unnecessarily?
Well, okay, let's say the mother who is raped births the baby. What if she hates the baby? Like, what if she just cannot care for the baby? Like, what if the baby comes out and she hates the baby because she got raped?
Well, there are 2 million families right now waiting to adopt children.
Okay.
So put it up for adoption. There are 2 million loving families that can't find kids.
I just find that very interesting because the adoption process is actually very difficult in America.
It is difficult. We can make it easier. But again, the issue is that there is a demand of families that want the babies.
Okay. And my last question that you, like you had started to answer, but you didn't answer what you said you were going to, was why, if your daughter were to be impregnated by rape, why would you force her to have the baby?
Well, first of all, because we don't murder in our family.
Okay.
Would you murder in your family?
No, but at the same time, I've done a little bit of research, and I just wanted to let you know that the chance of a 10-year-old surviving giving birth,
her baby, the full question was if...
is below 10%. So in reality, if you want your child to have a baby at 10 years old, you're not pro-birth. You're not pro-life. You're pro-birth.
Okay, again, to be very clear, I said if there was no issue with the mother's health. And understand, this is an extreme, hyper-personal example that someone used, and I'm happy to own it, but let's just be clear. Why is that example getting people so fired up? Because it's easy to say that you can murder a baby if it's small and that it's just, quote-unquote, a clump of cells.
No, I think that one instance got people so fired up because the age of your daughter and just because of the likelihood that she would survive and the baby would survive.
No, my answer was that if there were no medical complications. So you don't even remember the full answer. People get fired. Why does the age matter? Tell me why all of a sudden the age of the carrier matters.
Because that improves the infant mortality rate. Like, the older you are, the more likely you are to be able to carry a baby to term.
No, I know, but...
Thank you so much. So hopefully you're seeing there a cool, calm, confident, level-headed Charlie Kirk is able to use size, level of development, right? Environment, level of dependence. He's able to just go through and very calmly diffuse and getting to the point where he has someone making an argument for national policy based on 0.4% of pregnancies. And he actually got to a point where he said, so you agree that 99% of abortions in this country should not be allowed? And I don't know if you caught her answer. She said, yes, I agree. Isn't that incredible? Isn't that incredible? And the only thing she could kind of cling to there at the end was, well, what about the mom, the emotional distress? And there's an interesting study that was done. A study was done with women who had been raped, conceived as a result of rape, and ended up having the child, and they compared their mental health years after with someone who conceived from rape and had abortions. And what they found was the women who aborted the babies that had been conceived by rape actually had higher levels of depression, higher levels of suicide, a higher level of fragility when it came to their mental health, because now they had to deal with two traumatic things. Being raped, which is horrific, but also had to reckon with the fact that she had chosen to take the life of a human being. So in those arguments, I think it's helpful, first to point out, we're arguing for national policy based on 0.4% of cases. In what other area of public policy would we say that we should be creating policy based on 0.4% of circumstances? I can't think of any. I can't think of any, right? And the transgender thing would be just as insane, right? So it's just a helpful talking point. And I hope that you guys can see that as toxic as these kind of conversations can be, a calm, cool, level-headed conversation can be actually really, really helpful. I want to go ahead and jump to our next section here before we break. And one of the interesting things, as we recognize that science really upholds that humanity begins at conception, right? The scientists are saying that. The secular scientists are saying that. At the same time, we have what I like to call a national schizophrenia happening when it comes to abortion. Now, schizophrenia, if you're looking for like a clinical definition, schizophrenia is a persistent and pervasive loss of contact with reality characterized by beliefs that are not based on reality. Let me read that again. Schizophrenia is a persistent and pervasive loss of contact with reality characterized by beliefs that are not based on reality. And when it comes to abortion, there is a pandemic of schizophrenia in our country where people are making arguments that are not based on reality at all. Let me just share a few of those with you. When it comes to the death penalty, there are certain states in the United States that have outlawed the death penalty, but there's actually a lot of states that still have the death penalty. And if you look at this map here, what it shows is that these states, to varying degrees, they have laws on the book that if there is a woman who is pregnant, who is scheduled to be executed, the law says you cannot execute that woman because you would be taking innocent life in her womb. Just pause and think about that for a minute. You have a woman on death row, she has a baby inside her womb, and the government is saying it would be unjust to execute that woman while she is pregnant. She must have the baby first, and then you can execute her, because if you don't do that, you are unjustly taking the life of a human being. Isn't that interesting? Great conversation point to share with someone. This next one, I almost fell out of my chair the first time I saw this. This is in Minnesota, which is staunchly pro-choice, staunchly pro-choice. And the Minnesota fetal homicide laws, this is a state statute. It's statute 609.2661. The murder of unborn child in the first degree. This is a state statute in Minnesota. It reads this: whoever does any of the following is guilty of murder of an unborn child in the first degree and must be sentenced to imprisonment for life. No death penalty in Minnesota. And then it goes on to kind of communicate that whether it's sexual assault that takes the life of the baby in the womb or a carjacking, I mean, it literally says it in the law. If you kill a baby in the middle of a carjacking or if there's aggravated assault or armed robbery, it like stipulates all these different ways that if you kill a woman who is pregnant, it's going to be two counts of murder because you're taking the life of an unborn child in the womb. Okay, it's laid out, totally laid out. And then that state statute has a caveat. It has an exception. This is 609.269, Minnesota state statute. It says this: Section 609.2661 does not apply to a person providing reproductive health care offered, arranged, or furnished. Number one, for the purpose of terminating a pregnancy. And number two, with the consent of the pregnant individual or the pregnant individual's representative, except in a medical emergency in which consent cannot be obtained. Translation of the legalese: you cannot kill a baby unless the mother of the baby asks you to. That's what the law in Minnesota says. It says, listen, if you kill a woman and you kill the baby inside her womb, whether it's carjacking or aggravated assault, whatever it is, You are going to go to jail for the rest of your life. But there's one exception. If a reproductive health professional, with the permission of the baby's mother, kills the baby, it's not in violation of the law. That's schizophrenic. Like, just think about that for a minute. That's schizophrenic. It does not make any sense. Imagine explaining to a child, you cannot kill someone, you can't kill a baby unless the mom asks you to kill the baby. What? That's crazy. That doesn't make any sense. But it's a state statute in Minnesota. Here's another one. In the state of Illinois, a pregnant woman who takes an illegal drug can be prosecuted for, quote, delivering a controlled substance to a minor. Think about that for a minute, okay? So if you have a pregnant woman and she takes illicit drugs, the state of Illinois can prosecute her for delivering a controlled substance to a minor. But if that same mom goes to Planned Parenthood and says, I want you to kill my baby, the state says, no problem. If she does drugs, she's going to get arrested because she delivered a controlled substance to a minor. But if a doctor at Planned Parenthood tears her baby apart, it's no problem. It's no problem at all. Just think about that for a minute. It's schizophrenic. We're making decisions. We form beliefs that are totally detached from reality. And this is everywhere, everywhere in America. Last thing I want to share with you guys before we go ahead to the break, I want to talk to you about the ethnic implications of abortion. When it comes to the abortion conversation, this is the last conversation that pro-choice people want to have. This is a conversation that makes them squirm in their seats. This is a conversation that is incredibly poignant. We need to talk about the ethnic implications of abortion. This is so important. And to talk about the ethnic implications of abortion, we have to talk about the founding of the largest abortion provider in the United States, and that is Planned Parenthood. I did a little search and looked for the closest Planned Parenthood to Grace Bible Church, and it's this one in Shrewsbury, New Jersey. So Planned Parenthood is the number one abortion provider in the country. Does anyone know who founded Planned Parenthood? Because Planned Parenthood doesn't want you to know who founded Planned Parenthood. Who is it? Margaret Sanger, okay? Margaret Sanger. Margaret Sanger is coming of age, developing a worldview in a time in the early 20th century where eugenics was the rage, not only in Nazi Germany, but here in the United States. There's a Supreme Court case where the state of North Carolina had a law on the books that had forcible sterilization for people who were, quote, feebly minded. And the Supreme Court of the United States upheld it, saying you can forcibly sterilize someone who's unintelligent so that they do not procreate more unintelligent people. And the Supreme Court of the United States upheld it. This is a philosophy called eugenics. It was everywhere, everywhere in Western culture, but particularly in Nazi Germany. Eugenics simply means good breeding, and it means you want the desirable people to procreate, and the undesirable people, you want to prevent them from procreating. Do you know who embraced this worldview? Margaret Sanger. Margaret Sanger. And Planned Parenthood was founded on contraception. And do you know where Planned Parenthood was selling contraception? In Harlem. In Harlem. Margaret Sanger calls this, her words, the Negro Project, where they were going to communicate to the civic leaders of Harlem why it's so important to use contraception. She even went as far as to say, we must get the black pastors on board with contraception. Now, why are you targeting the black community for contraception? It doesn't take a genius to figure it out, because Margaret Sanger was a racist. Because she was a racist. This is the same ideology that sent 6 million Jews into gas chambers. This is the founding of Planned Parenthood. This is the founding of Planned Parenthood. Abortion was not legalized until after Margaret Sanger died. So she actually was against abortion, ironically. She thought it was barbaric. But she passed away before Roe was legalized in 1973. So she wasn't a part of instituting abortion. But Planned Parenthood was founded by a racist who wanted to control certain undesirable populations. Do you know what that means today? It means 78% of Planned Parenthood abortion clinics are in minority-majority communities in urban centers. Did you catch that? Planned Parenthood has 78% of their clinics are in black and brown communities in urban areas. 78%. And you know what that means? It means black babies in the United States are 5 times more likely to be aborted than their white counterparts. Hispanic babies are 2 times as likely to be aborted than their white counterparts. If you look at demographic studies, if you look at the U.S. Census, and you look at the black population going back to 1980, 1990, 2000, 2010, 2020, you track the black population in the United States, there's zero growth. There's zero growth because the black population in the United States has been systematically targeted by Planned Parenthood. Black babies are 5 times more likely to be aborted than white babies. That's crazy. And I remember back in, I think it was about 2007, I was listening to Pastor John Piper. I was out for a run. He's preaching a sermon on abortion. And he mentioned a pastor in New Jersey, in Montclair, New Jersey, Reverend Clenard Childress, who founded a website. So this is a pastor in North Jersey. I've met this man. He's a wonderful man. He loves Jesus Christ. And he is a courageous voice. A courageous voice for babies that don't have a voice. He founded an organization called blackgenocide.org. This guy's not messing around. You can go to the website, blackgenocide.org. And Reverend Childress has statistics about how Planned Parenthood targets babies in the black community. Pastor Childress and his wife regularly go to the abortion clinic in Montclair, New Jersey. And his wife will call out the young black men who are working as security guards outside of Planned Parenthood. She will personally call them out and say, "You are preventing black babies from being born. You are a part of the problem." These are incredibly courageous people. Incredibly courageous people. If you look around and pay attention, the black community is being systematically targeted by the abortion industry. This is a billboard. This is a billboard in Dallas, Texas. Just take a minute and see. Can you read that? Hopefully you can see it. Just look at the messaging of this billboard. This is in Dallas, Texas. It's communicating to black women that abortion is self-care. It's saying if you really care about yourself, then you'll kill your baby. Hashtag trust black women. This is crazy. This is crazy. Whether it's intentional or unintentional, the statistics don't lie. Black babies are 5 times more likely to be aborted than white babies. And I'm here to tell you that people who care about racial justice need to talk about this. They need to talk about this. Planned Parenthood has distanced themselves significantly from Margaret Sanger. This is a billboard that was in Manhattan in 2011. I don't know if you're able to read it. I'm going to read it for you. This is in downtown Manhattan. It says, "The most dangerous place for an African American is in the womb." The most dangerous place for an African American is in the womb. This was in 2011 in Manhattan. People were upset about this. The secret of Planned Parenthood is out. And I can tell you it's out. Back in November, we were with some friends. We went to Reading Terminal Market in Philadelphia, in Center City. And I had to run back to the car to get some water bottles for the kids. And I'm walking back to Reading Terminal Market. And I'm trying to cross the street. And a woman says, "Hey, would you donate to Planned Parenthood?" She has the vest on. She's raising money. She has flyers. She says, "You have a minute? Can I get a minute of your time?" And I said, you know what? I got to tell you, I don't think you want to talk to me. And she's like, why not? And I was like, because I am not in favor of Planned Parenthood. She's like, well, can you tell me why? So I'm like, so I just start going in on Margaret Sanger, okay? I'm like, hey, are you familiar with Margaret? Of course, it's the founder of Planned Parenthood. Are you familiar with eugenics? Do you know it's the same ideology that the Nazis had? And I'm going in, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, yeah, I am aware of it, actually. And we have totally condemned Margaret Sanger. She was like, Planned Parenthood doesn't do that anymore. I was like, oh, really? Well, why does Planned Parenthood have 78% of their clinics in minority-majority communities in urban centers? And so we're just like going back and forth. But you know what's so interesting? She knows that the secret's out. She had talking points to try to diffuse what has very clearly been historically a racist policy at Planned Parenthood. So my point is, like, the secret's getting out to the point that the Planned Parenthood workers who are like on the street corner in Philadelphia, they know that people like me are gonna say this to them. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, that was encouraging to me, right? As someone who's passionate about pro-life, they're back on their heels recognizing that the foundation of Planned Parenthood was inherently racist. That's a win. That's a win for us. And the last thing someone wants you to bring up in a conversation is that Planned Parenthood was founded by eugenicists and that they have systematically targeted the black community for abortion. That's a really compelling talking point. All right, we are ready for our break.